This mundanus that hardly ever saw the poorest utensil or ever took the meanest trifle into his hand without considering how it might be made or used to better advantage has gone all his life long praying in the same manner as when he was a child, without ever considering how much better or oftener he might pray, without considering how improbable the spirit of devotion is, how many helps a wise and reasonable man may call to his assistance, and how necessary it is that our prayer should be enlarged, varied, and suited to the particular state and condition of our lives. If mundanus sees a book of devotion, he passes it by as he does a spelling book, because he remembers that he learned to pray so many years ago under his mother when he learned to spell. Now how poor and pitiable is the conduct of this man of sense, who has so much judgment and understanding everything but that which is the whole wisdom of man, and how miserably do many people, more or less, imitate his conduct. All which seems to be owing to a strange, infatuated state of negligence, which keeps people from considering what devotion is. For if they did but once proceed so far as to reflect upon it, or ask themselves any questions concerning it, they would soon see that the spirit of devotion was like any other sense or understanding, that is only to be improved by study, care, application, and the use of such means and helps as are necessary to make a man a proficient in any art or science. Classicus, footnote 32. Classicus, a classical scholar, is a man of learning and well-versed in all the best authors of antiquity. He has read them so much that he has entered into their spirit and can very ingeniously imitate the manner of any of them. All their thoughts are his thoughts, and he can express himself in their language. He is so great a friend to this improvement of the mind that if he lights on a young scholar, he never fails to advise him concerning his studies. Classicus tells his young man he must not think that he has done enough when he has only learned languages, but that he must be daily conversant with the best authors, read them again and again, catch their spirit by living with them, and that there is no other way of becoming like them or of making himself a man of taste and judgment. How wise might Classicus have been, and how much good might he have done in the world if he had but thought as justly of devotion as he does of learning. He never, indeed, says anything shocking or offensive about devotion, because he never thinks or talks about it. It suffers nothing from him but neglect and disregard. The two testaments would not have had so much as a place amongst his books, but that they are both to be had in Greek. Classicus thinks that he sufficiently shows his regard for the Holy Scripture when he tells you that he has no other books of piety besides them. It is very well, Classicus, that you prefer the Bible to all other books of piety. He has no judgment. That is not thus far of your opinion. But if you will have no other book of piety besides the Bible, because it is the best, how comes it, Classicus, that you do not content yourself with one of the best books among the Greeks and Romans? How comes it that you are so greedy and eager after all of them? How comes it that you think the knowledge of one is a necessary help to the knowledge of the other? How comes it that you are so earnest, so laborious, so expensive of your time and money to restore broken periods and scraps of the ancients? How comes it that you read so many commentators upon Cicero, Horace, and Homer, and not one upon the Gospel? How comes it that you love to read a man? How comes it that your love of Cicero and Ovid makes you love to read an author that writes like them, and yet your esteem for the Gospel gives you no desire, nay, prevents your reading such books as breathe the very spirit of the Gospel? How comes it that you tell your young scholar he must not content himself with barely understanding his authors, but must be continually reading them all as the only means of entering into their spirit and forming his own judgment according to them? Why, then, must the Bible lie alone in your study? Is not the spirit of the saints, the piety of the holy followers of Jesus Christ, as good and necessary a means of entering into the spirit and taste of the gospel as the reading of the ancients is of entering into the spirit of antiquity? Is the spirit of poetry only to be got by much reading of poets and orators, and is not the spirit of devotion to be got in the same way by frequently reading the holy thoughts and pious strains of devout men? Is your young poet to search after every line that may give new wings to his fancy or direct his imagination? And is it not as reasonable for him who desires to improve in the divine life, that is, in the love of heavenly things, to search after every strain of devotion that may move, kindle, and inflame the holy ardor of his soul? Do you advise your orator to translate the best orations, to commit much of them to memory, to be frequently exercising his talent in this manner, that habits of thinking and speaking justly may be formed in his mind? And is there not the same benefit and advantage to be made by books of devotion? Should not a man use them in the same way, that habits of devotion and aspiring to God in holy thoughts may be well formed in his soul? Now the reason why Classicus does not think and judge thus reasonably of devotion is owing to his never thinking of it in any other manner than as the repeating a form of words. It never in his life entered his head to think of devotion as a state of the heart, as an improvable talent of the mind, as temper that is to grow and increase like our reason and judgment, and to be formed in us by such a regular diligent use of proper means as are necessary to form any other wise habit of mind. And it is for want of this that he has been content all his life with the bare letter of prayer and eagerly bent upon entering into the spirit of heathen poets and orators. And it is much to be lamented that numbers of scholars are more or less chargeable with this excessive folly, so negligent of improving their devotion and so desirous of other poor accomplishments, as if they thought it a nobler talent to be able to write an epigram in the turn of Martial than to live and think and pray to God in the spirit of St. Austin. And yet to correct this temper and fill a man with a quite contrary spirit, there seems to be no more required than the bare belief in the truth of Christianity. And if you were to ask Mundanus and Classicus, or any man of business or learning, whether piety is not the highest perfection of man, or devotion the greatest attainment in the world, they must both be forced to answer in the affirmative, or else give up the truth of the gospel. For to set any accomplishment against devotion, or to think anything or all things in this world bears any proportion to its excellency, is the same absurdity in the Christian as it would be in a philosopher to prefer a meal's meat to the greatest improvement in knowledge. For as philosophy professes purely the search and inquiry after knowledge, so Christianity supposes, intends, desires, and aims at nothing else but the raising fallen man to a divine life, to such habits of holiness, such degrees of devotion, as may fit him to enter amongst the holy inhabitants of the kingdom of heaven. He that does not believe this of Christianity may be reckoned an infidel, and he that believes thus much has faith enough to give him a right judgment of the value of things, to support him in a sound mind and enable him to conquer all the temptations which the world shall lay in his way. To conclude this chapter, devotion is nothing else but right apprehensions and right affections toward God. All practices, therefore, that heighten and improve our true apprehensions of God, all ways of life that tend to nourish, raise, and fix our affections upon Him, are to be reckoned so many helps and means to fill us with devotion. As prayer is the proper fuel of this holy flame, so we must use all our care and contrivance to give prayer its full power, as by alms, self-denial, frequent retirements, and holy readings, composing forms for ourselves, or using the best we can get, adding length of time and observing hours of prayer, changing, improving, and suiting our devotions to the condition of our lives and the state of our hearts. Those who have most leisure seem more especially called to a more eminent observance of these holy rules of a devout life. And they who, by the necessity of their state, and not through their own choice, have but little time to employ thus, must make the best use of that little they have. For this is a certain way of making devotion produce a devout life. Chapter 15. Of chanting or singing of psalms in our private devotions. Of the excellency and benefit of this kind of devotion. Of the great effects it hath upon our hearts. Of the means of performing it in the best manner. You have seen in the foregoing chapter what means and methods you are to use to raise and improve your devotion, how early you are to begin your prayers, and what is to be the subject of your first devotions in the morning. There is one thing still remaining that you must be required to observe, not only as fit and proper to be done, but as such as cannot be neglected without great prejudice to your devotions, and that is to begin all your prayers with a psalm. This is so right, is so beneficial to devotion, has so much effect upon our hearts, that it may be insisted upon as a common rule for all persons. I do not mean that you should read over a psalm, but that you should chant or sing one of those psalms, which we commonly call the reading psalms. For singing is as much the proper use of a psalm as devout supplication is the proper use of a form of prayer. And a psalm only read is very much like a prayer that is only looked over. Now the method of chanting a psalm, such as is used in the colleges, in the universities, and in some churches, is such as all persons are capable of. The change of the voice in thus chanting of a psalm is so small and natural that everybody is able to do it, and yet sufficient to raise and keep up the gladness of our hearts. You are, therefore, to consider this chanting of a psalm as a necessary beginning of your devotions, as something that is to awaken all that is good and holy within you, that is to call your spirits to your proper duty, to set you in your best posture towards heaven, and tune all the powers of your soul to worship and adoration. For there is nothing that so clears a way for your prayers, nothing that so disperses dullness of heart, nothing that so purifies the soul from poor and little passions, nothing that so opens heaven or carries your heart so near it, as these songs of praise. They create a sense and delight in God, they awaken holy desires, they teach you how to ask, and they prevail with God to give. They kindle a holy flame, they turn your heart into an altar, your prayers into incense, and carry them as a sweet-smelling savor to the throne of grace. The difference between singing and reading a psalm will easily be understood if you consider the difference between reading and singing a common song that you like. Whilst you only read it, you only like it, and that is all. But as soon as you sing it, then you enjoy it. You feel the delight of it. It has got hold of you. Your passions keep pace with it, and you feel the same spirit within you that seems to be in the words. If you were to tell a person that such a song, that he need not sing it, that it was sufficient to peruse it, he would wonder what you meant, and would think you as absurd as if you were to tell him that he should only look at his food, to see whether it was good, but not eat it. For a song of praise not sung is very like any other good thing not made use of. You will perhaps say that singing is a particular talent, that belongs only to particular people, and that you have neither voice nor ear to make any music. If you had said that singing is a general talent and that people differ in that as they do in all other things, you had said something much truer. For how vastly do people differ in the talent of thinking, which is not only common to all men, but seems to be the very essence of human nature. How readily do some people reason upon everything, and how hardly do others reason upon anything. How clearly do some people discourse upon the most abstruse matters, and how confusedly do others talk upon the plainest subjects. Yet no one desires to be excused from thought or reason or discourse because he has not these talents, as some people have them. But it is full as just for a person to think himself excused from thinking upon God, from reasoning about his duty to him, or discoursing about the means of salvation, because he has not these talents in any fine degree. This is full as just as for a person to think himself excused from singing the praises of God, because he has not a fine ear or a musical voice. For as it is speaking and not graceful speaking, that is a required part of prayer. As it is bowing and not genteel bowing, that is a proper part of adoration. So it is singing and not artful fine singing, that is a required way of praising God. If a person was to forbear praying because he had an odd tone in his voice, he would have as good an excuse as he has that forbears from singing psalms, because he has but little management of his voice. And as a man speaking his prayers, though in an odd tone, may yet sufficiently answer all the ends of his own devotion, so a man singing of a psalm, though not in a very musical way, may yet sufficiently answer all the ends of rejoicing in and praising God. Secondly, this objection might be of some weight, if you were desired to sing to entertain other people, but it is not to be admitted in the present case, where you are only required to sing the praises of God as a part of your private devotion. If a person that has a very ill voice and a bad way of speaking was desired to be the mouth of a congregation, it would be a very proper excuse for him to say that he had not a voice or a way of speaking that was proper for prayer. But he would be very absurd if, for the same reason, he should neglect his own private devotions. Now, this is exactly the case of singing psalms. You may not have the talent of singing so as to be able to entertain other people, and therefore it is reasonable to excuse yourself from it. But if for that reason you should excuse yourself from this way of praising God, you would be guilty of a great absurdity, because singing is no more required for the music that is made by it than prayer is required for the fine words that it contains, but as it is the natural and proper expression of a heart rejoicing in God. Our blessed Savior and his apostles sang a hymn, but it may reasonably be supposed that they rather rejoiced in God than made fine music. Do but so live that your heart may truly rejoice in God, that it may feel itself affected with the praises of God, and then you will find that this state of your heart will neither want a voice nor ear to find a tune for a psalm. Every one at some time or other finds himself able to sing in some degree. There are sometimes and occasions of joy that make all people ready to express their sense of it in some sort of harmony. The joy that they feel forces them to let their voice have a part in it. He, therefore, that saith he wants a voice or an ear to sing a psalm, mistakes the case. He wants that spirit that really rejoices in God. The dullness is in his heart and not in his ear. And when his heart feels a true joy in God, when it has a full relish of what is expressed in the psalms, he will find it very pleasant to make the motions of his voice express the motions of his heart. Singing, indeed, as it is improved into an art, as it signifies the running of the voice through such and such a compass of notes, and keeping time with a studied variety of changes, is not natural, nor the effect of any natural state of the mind. So in this sense, it is not common to all people, any more than those antic and invented motions which make fine dancing are common to all people. But singing, as it signifies a motion of the voice suitable to the motions of the heart, and the changing of its tone according to the meaning of the words which we utter, is as natural and common to all men as it is to speak high when they threaten in anger, or to speak low when they are dejected and ask for a pardon. All men, therefore, are singers in the same manner as all men think, speak, laugh, and lament, for singing is no more an invention than grief or joy are inventions. Every state of the heart naturally puts the body into some state that is suitable to it, and is proper to show it to other people.